Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner.
I'm Anthony McCarthy. Mark, before we begin, because we have a great show, I want us, on behalf of the Center for Emerging Media and the Steiner Show, wish our colleagues LaDonna and Bassman happy birthday. Their birthdays are both today.
Both today.
So we want to make sure that we send out lots of love to them and the great work they do here at WEA.
Oh, that's great. And I guess while we're giving congratulations, we should say, since we're broadcasting from the WEA at the Morgan State University, which is
congrats.
With
congratulations right.
to the Morgan State University Bears, who are going to go to the NCAA
Isn't that
finals
something?
Again.
Cool. Again. Yeah. Exciting.
It's wild. So all that.
All that. Congrats all that. To everybody.
But we're going to talk about, in this first hour, a report that was written by Mariko Chang, who works at Insight, the Center for Community Economic Development. It's called Lifting As We Climb, Women of Color Wealth in America's Future. She's also author of a forthcoming book on the gender wealth gap called Shortchanged, Why Women Have Less Wealth and What Could Be Done About It. And she's an associate professor of sociology at Harvard University, or was, from 1998 to 2007. And LaToya Peterson, who's been on here before, is an editor and frequent contributor at racialicious.com. And she wrote some really interesting commentary on this report.
She sure did.
And really hit it well. And joins us as well for the first part of our program. LaToya's not coming off another 10 minutes. I'm sorry. I apologize. But when she gets here, we'll get her right on. So, Mariko Chang, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
The number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. This report, it's really stunning. I mean, I was blown away when I read it. Just because, I mean, we always knew there was an income gap between men and women in America, between blacks and whites in America, between people of color and the white population in America. But this was just nothing I was prepared for. Before we begin, could just define for us for a moment what we mean by wealth and how that's different than, like, income or money.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, we're used to really thinking about how well people are doing by using income.
That's right.
And that includes, for most people, wages or a salary. But it's pretty much any income or any money that comes into the household. So it can take other forms, too. Social Security is a form of income. So is unemployment benefits. So it's really anything that comes into the household. Wealth, on the other hand, is net worth, which is defined as the value of your assets minus your liabilities. So assets would include things like any money held in checking or savings accounts. If you own a home, stocks, or retirement assets, and I guess what would subtract from that would be your liabilities or your debt. So the mortgage that you owe on a home, if you own one, credit card debt, loans, things like that. Now, the important distinction, really, is that wealth is what helps you get through economic crises, such as the one that we have now. You know, it essentially lets you pay the bills, but it also has other benefits. It can be passed down from generation to generation. You can use it as collateral for loans, and it itself can be a form of income-generating activity if you get dividends or rent. But one of the things that I think most people don't understand is just how unequally distributed wealth is. So that was kind of a startling finding that we also tried to emphasize, but other research has shown that wealth inequality generally is much, much greater than income inequality. And let me just give you an example. In 2004, the top 1% of the population, so these are the richest of the rich, they earned 17% of the total income and held 34% of the total wealth. Mm. So that's the richest 1% have about a third of the wealth. But the bottom 60%, and that's the 60, earned 22% of the income, but had only 4% of the wealth. So that's a very startling statistic as well. So, you know, the first thing I want to point out is that the wealth inequality, we should all be concerned about it because it is much, much, much greater than income inequality.
And as we let this unfold this hour and this conversation, this document unfold, and what Mariko Chang has developed here in her thesis, we'll get back to the question of wealth and what that means for the future of America. And very specifically, Anthony, you raise this issue. Maybe I should let you raise it about when we were talking in the green room about that the perceptions of where black women are
most
in America.
Definitely.
Why don't you...
Marika, I think that two things I want to start our conversation with is this idea that people need to know that we're not, that we didn't make a mistake when we said $5 is the median wealth for African-American women. And I want you to explain that because there's a lot going around the online and blogs. People are stunned by that number and stunned by your study. But the other thing is this perception of how upwardly mobile African-American women are in our society, that they are better educated, they are better employed, they are reaching levels of management in the private sector as well as the public sector when it comes to government and nonprofits. There is this perception that African-American women are setting the pace for people of color when it comes to success, wealth building, and income.
Right.
And I think what your study has unfolded for us is that there is the perception could be a little bit off, but there is a huge difference in income and wealth and the debt that is being accumulated as women of color, of all colors, begin to climb that ladder towards success. That these loans, credit cards, mortgages, that this debt in many ways becomes a catch-22. I mean, they are succeeding and making strides, but the debt is almost unmanageable at times. So
right,
let me
absolutely.
Get your thoughts on that.
Sure. I guess I want to speak to the two different kind of central types of questions that you're asking. One is about the $5 figure.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other is about, you know, well, what's going on? Because African-American women and women of color, you know, have really made tremendous strides. So let me take, you know, both of those questions. First, around the $5 figure, this is something that's been, as you know, commented on quite frequently, and it's kind of hard to keep track of all the comments that are going on around it. But there is an important clarification, because early on, the report was unfortunately somewhat misquoted with the $5 figure. The $5 figure that's floating around is in the report, but it refers to all non-white and or Hispanic women, so it's not just black women.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it refers to women, single women, between the ages of 36 and 49. So that's a specific age group. So I just want to make that clear.
Thank you.
So that
yeah.
when people actually look at the report, they're not confused. But still, if you look at the median wealth for black women specifically, all ages, you see that they have a median wealth of $100, and Hispanic women have a median wealth of $120. So this is across the age group, and that's broken down, I guess, between black and Hispanic women. And I wasn't able to disaggregate Asians or Native Americans from the larger data because their sample sizes are too small.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, those are the numbers that I want the reader to know. And it's still very startling. I mean, the difference between $5 and 100 or 120 is still, you know, a tremendous, you know, gap. And if you look at women of color and their gap in comparison to men of color or in comparison to white women, what you see is that women of color own about a penny for every dollar's worth of wealth owned by their same race male counterpart, and a fraction of a penny of the wealth that's owned by single white women. So those are still startling figures.
I really want to talk about this. This is what you just quoted is on page 5 of your study. And when you say that the single black women have median wealth of $100 and Hispanic
right.
women $120,
right.
and their male counterparts, black men at $7,900 and was it? I had that backwards, don't I? And $9,730 for black men and $7,900 for Latino men. That's huge. So let's talk about why that is. I mean, what are the factors here? One of the things you talk about in your report in one of the subtexts here is the role that children play.
Right. Right.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. No, I'm finished. Please finish your question.
No, that was it. I'm not going to belabor the question. I want you to just kind of talk about that for a minute. I think that
sure.
that single women or women of color who have to raise children, men have this larger wealth, but they're not involved, I think, in the many times are not involved in the life of children, and women carry this burden
and the expense of children
Right, right. And actually, I mean, this is one of the major points of the report and the book. Although the report speaks specifically and more, you know, with respect to women of color, but all women experience what I call the motherhood wealth tax, which essentially means that, you know, if you're even if you're married, your labor force participation and your wages are affected, you know, by children. And there's a wage penalty that economists have found for women who have children that they can't explain by things like education and years of experience and age. So there's definitely effects on wages that children have, but also for single women. Whoever has custody of children is likely to bear a disproportionate financial responsibility. You know, it's sort of inherent in the job.
Mm-hmm.
And so women of color and any woman, any single woman who is a custodial parent will not be able to save and invest to the same extent because they are supporting more than one person on their income. And I think we all know that two people, you know, can't live as cheaply as one.
That's right.
So In fact, that's actually one of the main reasons why I think we should, although income is absolutely important, that even if we closed the income gap between men and women, women would still have less wealth because of this custodial parenthood factor. But also because women in general, but especially women of color, are much less likely to have access to something that I've termed the wealth escalator. And so that's also another important component.
The wealth aspirator?
The escalator.
Escalator.
Right, right. Well, and I can tell you.
Before we get to the escalator, let me take a step backwards. One of the things that you talk about also that really has institutionalized the wealth gap in America that adversely affects black women and women of color is the history of America and how wealth is handed down and the role of inheritance.
Right, absolutely. And there's been a lot of work that's been done by Melvin Oliver and Thomas Shapiro on the black-white wealth gap. They've written a couple of books, and I think they're really valuable. And they explain how this sort of legacy, or what they call the sedimentation of inequality, happens. And, you know, we think that what's happened in the past, that, okay, there were differences in opportunities for people of color to build wealth. You know, they had less access to many of the other opportunities. They were excluded in many ways from wealth building. But people don't see how that carries forth from generation to generation, because when people have wealth, even if it's a small amount, they can pass it to future generations. And we usually think of people having a large inheritance. Mm-hmm. That's really not the only way. They pass it more indirectly oftentimes through things like being able to pay for their children's college education, let's say, as opposed to having their children take out loans. And that's actually something I'd like to get back to, because that also is important for women of color. But also assistance with a down payment for a home, let's say, things like that that give people a slight advantage, might allow them to purchase a home maybe a few years sooner than they would have if they had their own savings, or maybe a little bit more expensive home than they would have been able to purchase. And all those things accumulate, and they help people to build more wealth over their lifetime, because wealth, you know, wealth begets wealth, I guess, suffice it to say. And we don't really think about that. And people don't talk about, you know, how much wealth they have or how wealthy their parents are, how large their inheritance was. So we really don't have a good idea of what's going on in other families except for our own.
And I want to ask real quick before we jump into so many elements of this, and we're starting to get a lot of callers who want to weigh in on this conversation also. You mentioned, and I can't remember where it is in the report, Mark, but it mentions that women of color are more likely to help family members, to give personal loans,
right,
to assist with things like you were talking about, Marika, about student loans, or not student loans, but education, college costs, and those kinds of things, and help get your first house and those type of things. Where does those statistics or that information come from?
Right. Well, there's actually a lot of research that's been done in the social sciences and economics that looks at people's intra-household given.
Yeah.
You know, they have fancy sociological and economics terms for everything. But basically, you know, what do people do with their money? How much do they help out family members, let's say? And they have shown that even though women of color have generally fewer economic resources, they generally give a lot more, you know, in proportion.
Mm-hmm.
In part because, you know, they tend to come from, let's say, less wealthy families, just, you know, based, you know, on historical factors. So they find themselves in the situation of oftentimes, you know, sharing the resources that they do have, you know, with sisters, with brothers, with parents. So, you know, they're very generous. They don't just say, you know, this is my money and I'm going to climb the wealth ladder and leave you all behind. You know, they really look out for other people in their community. And, of course, white people do this, too. I mean, I don't want to say that they don't. But because there's, you know, fewer resources going around, you know, they're still sharing those resources. So it benefits perhaps those around them, but it doesn't necessarily help them accumulate any more wealth.
You can join us here at 410-319-8888. Anthony McCarthy and I in this first hour are talking with Mariko Chang, whose report is called Lifting as We Climb, Women of Color, Wealth, and America's Future. It's interesting, the title that she picked, as she talks about in the beginning of her study. This was the title of a report from the National Association of Colored Women in the early part of the 20th century, who had to come together to defend black women in America who are being viciously attacked on many levels. And she used that title for this. And part of the issue we're talking about here is the fact that in America, that the wealth of black women, a single black woman in America, is only $100 without a car we're talking about. With a car, that becomes $5,000. These are important because when you compare that to even single black men, it's $7,900. And if you look at in terms of a black family, it's $32,000. And if you look at a white non-Latino family in America, I'm sorry, I prefer than Hispanic, but the Latino family, it's $162,500. There is disparity in America. The question is why. And we also want to hear your own stories, your experiences with this as women and men in our culture and society, and what you think is going on here. We're going to, and why it's happening. And we're also going to talk with Mariko Chang during the course of this hour about what she sees in her report as ideas about how America can change this and break this cycle that is historic, as she writes about. Historic because wealth has always belonged in a certain sector. There's been no inheritance from black families to their children because there's no wealth to inherit. So 410-319-8888, your thoughts on this? Despite the growing numbers, which we'll talk about as well, of women, businesses owned by Latinos, Native Americans, black women, that's growing exponentially. But there's a disconnect here with our culture. And the disconnect growing as the economy falls. 410-319-8888 is the number here. We'll be joined by LaToya Peterson in a little bit, who'll be joining us, who is editor and frequent contributor to racialissues.com, who's written about this as well. We're now joined by Mariko Chang. 410-319-8888. Let's go right to the phones and hear what folks have to say. Michael in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hey, Mark. Michael Scott here. How you doing?
Oh, welcome. Good to have you
on
the
air.
Good. Hey, Anthony. So I love what she's saying. I think one of the things that we always have to remind folks that I think she hinted at, but at the very moment of the creation of the middle class in America, only 2% of all minorities participated. You know, the GI Bill, which, you know, kind of standardized the process to, you know, get a home, to get a college education, and only 2% of all Americans, of all minorities, participated. And so that's a direct link to generational wealth, because as she pointed out, all the gateway, all the triggers to wealth creation, starting with, you know, how much skin you have in the game in terms of starting a business, you know, inheriting a debt-free house that you can use for a line of credit or for college education or for health care emergencies, and all of that relates to, you know, what sort of our trajectory as a society is, and the middle class left us out at the very moment it was created. And so then when you compound on top of that, you know, the isms of sexism and the differentials and opportunities and what she was talking about, the vulnerabilities of of single parenthood, and particularly given the other stats we know in the communities of color with the cradle to prison pipeline, and you kind of have a real roadmap as to why that gap exists. And in terms of my two cents on how you create it, I think you have to target it. Target some proven wealth creation strategies, and expand those. But that's I'm not talking reparations here, but more targeted SBA dollars or expanded pools of capital that we're not currently looking at. I mean, the pension funds of bus drivers. When you start adding up Black folks and Latino folks who do those kinds of jobs and have millions of dollars in pension funds, you have to say, well, how many minority managers are there and how many minority businesses are they investing in? So it's not always a government solution, but those are a couple of my thoughts.
Michael, thanks so much.
Wow, great. You covered a lot of stuff.
Marika, what are your comments to Michael?
I think he hit the nail on the head. I'm so glad that he mentioned the GI Bill, because this was an incredible piece of legislation and benefited many, many people and helped them, make a step up to the middle class by providing them with access primarily to education and home ownership. But people of color were really left out of that. And so that was one of the ways, let's say, that our government has really helped people build wealth. But yet, if you were excluded from that, you were left out of an opportunity, and that, those differences are still being felt today. So I'm so glad that he mentioned that. I think he really hit the nail on the head.
410-319-8888. Let's go to Fran in Catonsville. You're on the air.
Hi, Mark. How are you today?
And I'm well. Welcome.
Great. I just heard her say about how the Black women tend to give more. Well, I'm one of those 56-year-old Black female that has come from a family of eight in the South, educated myself, through the help of my family and Pell Grants. And we were taught to reach back. So in doing so, I've reached back. I've helped nephew go to college, buy books, buy clothes. This is what we were taught to do, and you feel obligated, but you also realize that if you don't do it, then who's going to do it?
And how much is that what Fran was saying, how much does that really affect this question of wealth in America?
Well,
Mariko?
Oh, well, that's precisely the types of stories that I hear, that, people are helping out other family members. And, while this is an absolutely wonderful thing that she's doing, if you think of it from a purely selfish perspective, which I'm glad that people don't, I'm glad people help other people, but if you think of it from a purely selfish perspective, that's money that she wasn't able to save, let's say for retirement or for other emergencies. So you can understand then how her income might not go as far in creating wealth as someone else who might have the exact same income but is not reaching back. So I think she did an excellent job explaining what the situation is for many women.
410-319-8888 is the number here. Before Anthony and I jump back into our own thoughts and questions, let me go back to the phones, and Clarence, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Mark. How are you?
I'm well. Welcome.
Yeah. A contributing factor, look at the generations. At my age group at 56, the priority with my parents and grandparents was home ownership. And the generation after, their priority shift. And a lot of that wealth that she's talking about, material wealth that is associated with home ownership, they were sold immediately for other things. And I think that has a big contributing factor, too. Is a big contributing factor.
What other things, Clarence? I just want more clarity on how you see this differential between these generations.
They were more, shall we say, like a house is a tangible asset.
Okay.
That will be there all the time for you, as opposed to cars and clothes and other things like that.
Mm-hmm.
That are, they're here today and gone tomorrow.
So did you find anything in terms of generational issues when you study, Mariko?
Well, that wasn't the focus of this particular study, so I feel like I can't speak to that issue as clearly as I would like to. But I do think that you know, there's been tremendous changes, you know, across generations, and whether it's, you know, values, you know, of home ownership, let's say, or saving, or whether it's other factors like the fact that with the change, you know, in the subprime mortgage market, many people who would perhaps not have been able to buy a home, or at least not yet, you know, given the amount they had for a down payment, were able to do so. So there could very well be generational differences, but I don't know if they would be racially different. So it could be that this current generation, you know, might have different ideas. They might not. But I don't see it as being located specifically in, you know, in a particular racial group. But I think that is an important question that should be answered. And maybe that will be our next step to see whether there are these generational differences.
There's a lot of questions about how we can resolve some of this in America. But what about the interplay between marriage and non-marriage and the growth of the numbers of people in America who are not married and not getting married, or have been married and divorced and never marry again, which is huge in the African American world and except for the Asian world, is a growing phenomenon.
That's right. And we see marriage as a wealth builder because it brings those incomes together.
And even if you take the huge disparity between black and white and white and people of color, period, marriages, whether it's the fact there's $32,500 is the cumulative wealth of African-American married families. Is that right? Yeah, married families. Mm-hmm. And $30,000 for Latinos. It's $162,000 for whites in America. The gap is huge, but still there is that makes the gap between married black families and single black women just unbelievable. I mean,
right.
$32,000 to $100. So, I mean, that's a huge factor here. So the question is, I wonder what that says about the fabric of society. And not that I'm one of these people who says everybody has to be married and that's the only way to make society work, because all kinds of people are doing their different things in America at the moment, trying to find their way to kind of create this new world of ours. But that clearly has had an effect on the ability of women of color to hold on to wealth and grow wealth.
Right. All the research that I've seen shows that married couples are wealthier. And that shouldn't surprise us.
No. Mm-hmm.
You know, for all the reasons that we would expect. You know, there's two incomes, or if there's, you know, one income, you know, people can pool resources. So there's a lot of reasons why we're not surprised by the fact that married people are wealthier. But I think it would be a huge step to therefore say that, you know, just hypothetically, that if all women were married or all people were married, that we would see, you know, these tremendous changes, let's say, in the racial wealth gap or even in the gender wealth gap. And I just want to elaborate on some of the reasons. First, sociologists have shown that as people get married, you know, they've been tracking changes over time, and that people are increasingly likely to marry others of their same social class. So, ironically, now that women, you know, are able to earn so much more in the labor market than they were, let's say, 40, 50 years ago, extremely high-earning women are likely to marry extremely high-earning men, you know, all else being equal. And lower-earning women are more likely to marry lower-earning men. So what you see, actually, is with a pooling of resources, you actually sometimes see the class disparities growing, where the married, you know, wealthier households then have even more wealth, and the married, less wealthy, don't have as much wealth. But there's also a factor that people overlook, and that is that, not only are people not marrying as much as they were, but they're marrying later, and they're spending actually larger percentages of their lives unmarried, whether that's because they get married later or because they divorce. But also for women tend to marry men who are on average about 2 years older than they are, and women live longer. So just demographically, women are likely to outlive their husbands even if they do stay married. And at the older age range, you see women outnumbering men by a tremendous proportion. So it's almost impossible, actually, for all women, you know, to stay married until they pass.
We're going to take a short break, and we're going to come right back. And Marie is going to be our next caller up, who has a question about Indigenous women. So hold on. There's several other callers behind you that we'll get to. And we want to explore a number of things. We're going to explore if this actually is true about the average wealth, which it is, I'm sure, $100 of wealth for a single black woman in America, $120 for a Latino woman, then if there are a number of people who make a great deal of money who are African-American or Latino, what does that say about the state of poor women of color in America today? And we're going to start looking at what we can do to turn this around in America. Is there a way to turn it around, or is the implosion of capitalism not going to allow it to happen at all? Anthony McCarthy and I will be back to talk about that with Mariko Chang, who wrote the study, Lifting As We Climb, Women of Color, Wealth, and America's Future. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. In this month's issue, four teams of collaborators explore four very different visions of the city. It's the Urbanite Project, a special annual issue devoted to showcasing outside-the-box thinking from Baltimore's most creative minds. Urbanite is available at over 800 locations. You can visit www.urbanitebaltimore.com for a list of drop locations. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner.
I'm Anthony McCarthy.
I was going through adolescence.
What's going on?
and I want to remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News and World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. Anthony and I are joined by Mariko Chang, who wrote the new report, Lifting As We Climb, Women of Color, Wealth, and America's Future. And since there was a piece in that report that talked about the average wealth being $5 for black women in America, it kind of exploded across the scene. But it should explode across the scene because what says is very an important issue for us to face in America. She's also author of the forthcoming book called The Gender Wealth Gap, Short Change, Why Women Have Less Wealth and What Can Be Done About It. She was associate professor of sociology at Harvard University from 1998 to 2007. Joins us here now at 410-319-8888. Aha. And we're also joined at this moment by LaToya Peterson, who is editor and frequent contributor to racialicious.com. And LaToya, welcome. Good to have you with us.
LaToya?
LaToya there? We have her up? All right, let me know when we have her, and I will put it right back on.
Mark, I wanted to say something because, you know, I talk a lot about my grandmother and a lot of the very just tremendous women who helped raise me and our family. I remember it appears there is this breakdown because my grandmother was an expert saver. And I always had this perception of, I don't want to say previous African-American generations, as just knowing how to save because they had to. Knowing how to save so you can get into that house, knowing how to save so that you can get that car, knowing how to save because education was important. So you pass on that, not just the lessons about the importance of education, but having those extra dollars to help that grandchild get into school and afford school. I have a lot, and the reason I was so shocked by this report was because a lot of the perceptions I have about the women that are my colleagues and my friends, African-American women of color, Latino women, is that they are making these enormous strides. But now I know they are managing more debt. They are doing things that other demographics don't necessarily have to do with the wealth they're able to accumulate. They have more responsibilities. It's a catch-22. They're that vicious cycle of using your credit cards to afford other opportunities, but then those debts come due, and not having the wealth or have accumulated the wealth to be able to manage all that. This is a tremendous report. Marika, you are to be just, what's the word, Mark? You're just really to be congratulated and lauded for pulling all this together. I know it was enormous, enormous work.
It was, and I have to say that I did not do it alone. So there was a working group as well at the Insight Center that, you know, made contributions, you know, really helped get me up to speed. Also, the director of the Closing the Racial Wealth Gap Initiative, Meiju Louie, was a tremendous resource and made some significant contributions to the paper. In fact, I want to clarify that I did not come up with the Lifting as We Climb title.
Mm-hmm.
I would have loved to. I'm just not that creative. I don't have a good title making. And she was really the one who came up with that and also recognized the parallels, to what was going on more than a century ago with the National Association for Colored Women. So I just want to make sure that I give credit where credit is due.
That's important.
That is, you know, that was tremendous, and I would love to take credit for it, but I can't.
But did you have any of those same perceptions about women of color, your colleagues, women who work in academia, that they really were making strides, that they really had their hands on a lot more wealth than generations before them?
Oh, absolutely. Especially when you hear the statistics, such as black women now are surpassing black men in rates of college completion.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Women generally, actually, are now surpassing men. We have women and women of color in occupations that we never, or maybe we thought were possible, but we had no idea. You know, the tremendous strides that people are making now. But just let me give the example, for instance, of education. Now that we do have women more likely to go to college than men, we've also seen skyrocketing costs in education. And I think that's where a lot of this begins, actually, because the cost of going to college has risen so tremendously, mm-hmm. From generations prior. And also, there's less money available in the form of grants. So now people have to take on more loans than they did in the past in order to pay for their college. So by the time that people graduate from college, they're already in a tremendous amount of debt, especially if they come from families that aren't able
right.
to help them pay for those costs. So I think we really need to take a look actually on what's going on with the financing of higher education, because a lot of it really starts there. Not to mention that people are bombarded with credit cards from pretty much the moment they step onto a college campus. But that debt actually, when people are that young and have such a limited amount of, credit history, they can't borrow as much money as they can, I believe, on a credit card as they can in a student loan.
Hmm.
So I really think we need to think about, what we're doing to this current generation by essentially burdening them with these tremendous college costs.
Let me go back to the phones here and get some of our listeners back in at 410-319-8888. They want to talk about some things we can do. And I think also LaToya Peterson, you back with us? It says, okay. Let me know when she's here. 410-319-8888. And Marie, you're on the air.
Good evening, everybody.
Good evening, Marie.
I tuned in a little late, and I was wondering about the indigenous women. Have they been in this report? And then another thing with African-American women, some of them are more in the population than African men, and they are advised to marry down those African-American with higher education in order to obtain a man.
Mm.
Yeah, they're been told to marry down.
You know, she's right, Mark, and I have two nieces who've been advised by older aunts to, I don't want to say compromise or settle, but they are told constantly, these are two of my really bright nieces, you know what, you are too picky about who you're looking for. And they're saying, is it too much to ask? And I remind them all the time, you go with your heart. And I like to think that they're going to marry wealthy men who have something going on. But if they marry some bums and they're good to them, I won't be that heartbroken. I won't be that heartbroken.
But and Mariko, you can comment on that as well. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. And what the study said. Also, you do cover indigenous women. There's a
Definitely.
Problem with
mm-hmm.
kind of
Those
studying
statistics.
Indigenous cultures in America when it comes to women, just because of the lack of research.
Sure, sure. This is actually one of the key recommendations to come out of the report, is that we need to collect more data, because Native American women and Asian women, they are included in the category of women of color. So, for instance, in that $5 category for women ages 36 to 49. But because of their small sample sizes, the survey doesn't release, I guess, those numbers separately for Asians and for people of other races. So they're all lumped together in one category. And so I didn't draw them out separately because I just wasn't able to really do anything meaningful just because they're a smaller sample size. So, I mean, one of the primary, in fact, I think it's our first recommendation in the report, is that we need to collect better and more data. We need to, what they call, oversample other racial groups so that we can actually say some meaningful things about those differences. So they are included, but I can't actually disaggregate with other groups other than the Black and the Hispanic, I'm very sad to say.
Let me go back to the phones. I think LaToya is with us. LaToya Peterson, welcome to have you with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm sorry, I'm coming to you from South by Southwest, so things are a little choppy and a little crazy.
I was going to say, if he says your name one more time and you're not there, we're going to give up on you.
Never give up on you, LaToya.
I'm like running through the convention center, trying to find a space, and a space I get reception, and then like I found a place, and then somebody else came in and decided to start like, literally singing a song. I was like, really? I'm here with you now. I'm sorry. I'm here with you.
It's good to have you. Editor and frequent contributor to Racial Issues, one of our famous writers out there who's always on the edge of stuff. Talk about why this study about women of color in America just grabbed you so deeply. I've been reading what you've been writing.
Oh, my God. It's so major, right? Because I was already finished. I was packed for South by Southwest. And then I got an email from a friend who got a email blast from the Insight Foundation like, hey, there's this great report on women of color and wealth. We should cover it. And so when I read it, I requested an advanced copy. And I read it, and I was just blown away, not by the data, because it's not really surprising, particularly from my experience. I'm an African-American woman. I grew up low class. So I'm really aware of a lot of the dynamics discussed within this report. But when you look at the depth of the damage and we really put it in the context, which is what Mariko Chang and everyone else at the Insight Center did, which is really put it in the context of historically exclusionary policies and context of gender discrimination toward women and all the things that we could not achieve until the 70s. You know, this is a scant like 40 years ago that we received all of these rights and all of these things that a lot of people take for granted, and looking at the kind of damage that is wrought on wealth building. And it's a huge issue for me. I love women in finance. I love discussing these things and, you know, our career advice and trying to make better financial decisions and financial empowerment. And so this report spoke to me in a number of ways.
Well, I'm curious about how it spoke to you in terms of what it says to you as a young Black woman and what you around you as with people you know in your own life.
Definitely. Well, you know, I grew up low class, and I'll just go ahead and just put that out there.
You always say that, LaToya.
I do, because I want people to be like, okay, well, you're so biased. Well, totally, yeah, everyone's biased by their experiences. And so when I grew up, my mom was really trying. She was a single-parent household. My father was in the picture, which was unique among my friend group. You know, a lot of my friends couldn't even talk about their fathers without, like, a curse word. So the fact that I knew who my father was, he acknowledged me, and he provided some form of financial support to the household was a huge deal. It was very unusual. And one of the things as life went on is kind of seeing growing up in, you know, I grew up in Montgomery County, Maryland, which is a very affluent suburb. It used to be one of the richest in the nation. Now it's like in the top 20s or something ridiculous, but it's still very wealthy. And so being poor on the edge of all of this wealth and all this access made for a really kind of jarring experience for me. You know, for my family, it was a huge deal to have an extra $20. It was a huge deal. When I worked and I would get an after-school job, and I've been working since I was 12, I used to nanny for this other woman, which is another interesting story. So I used to nanny for her because she was a nanny for someone else while she was waiting for her green card to get her refugee status.
Whoa.
So I was nannying her children so she could take care of another family's children. But that's a whole other story. So I did that when I was 12. Then I started getting jobs as soon as I can get a work permit. And I've been working most of my life. But a lot of times before I moved out, most of my wages went to help maintain the household. They weren't things that I could save. And I had to still give money to my mom and then pay school expenses out of that, you know, field trips, things that wealthier families don't necessarily think about, you know, money for lunch for the kids.
Right.
A field trip, you know, once a month, something like that. SAT tests, because that costs, AP tests. All those things were things I had to work for and save for. I never got a driver's license because I couldn't afford to take both the cost of the class, which at the time was like $200, and miss 2 weeks of work at the same time. I couldn't afford it. And so I never got a driver's license. I'm actually getting one this year. And so, it's ridiculous. I'm 26 years old. But it's one of those things where all of these things build together. And combine into like this meta narrative about women of color and wealth. And when you are in a single parent household, and when your parents are really scraping, trying to make ends meet, and when your mom has to do things like put a utility bill in your name so that the lights will be back on or the phone will be back on. And if she defaults on that payment later, then that goes on your credit report. You know, I was listening to the Steve Harvey Morning Show the other day, and they had, I think Judge Mathis was on, randomly just giving people legal advice. And a woman had called in with the exact same problem that I ran into when I moved out on my own, which is, you know, there were some things taken out my name when I was a kid. Clearly, I couldn't have signed for them. They were defaulted upon, and now I had these blemishes on my credit report before I even got into the credit market. And the only solution, the only recourse in that is for you to sue your parents. And it becomes, like, this is a huge issue. Like, I'm not going to sue my mom for trying to make sure that we had power. But at the same time, that starts me out with a negative credit rating. I already have a ding on my record. I haven't even started yet. And it just goes from there. And so as I grew up and as I learned a little bit more about money, as I started making more money, as I got connected to people who understood money a lot better, like my friend's parents who were very wealthy and who owned businesses and owned homes and could talk about these things. Like, the first time I ever heard house poor was from one of my friends. I never even knew there was a such thing as house poor, much less that kind of poor in relation to, like, welfare poor, which was what we were. I had no idea.
So
understanding those things has really been kind of eye-opening.
LaToya Peterson is with us. She's editor and frequent contributor at racialicious.com. Mariko Chang is author of the report she has been writing about recently, Lifting as We Climb, Women of Color, Wealth, and America's Future. I'd like to get a couple of caller in here, and then if you both can hang out for a minute with Anthony and I for just another 10 minutes till the end of this hour. 410-319-8888. Carla in Southwest, you're on the air.
Good evening. How are you gentlemen and ladies today?
Well, hey, Carla.
Welcome.
Good. Thank you.
Great. One of the comments that one of the callers made, and Anthony, you commented on, is in terms of the type of men that women of color are advised to marry, particularly African-American women who are very well educated. And I just want to relay a brief story that I read in Hill Harper's book, The Conversation, when it talks about, you know, marrying the type of people that we marry. I think that sometimes it's not always good to look at the person who has arrived, but look at the person who has a goal. Because sometimes, you know, you need to look at the character of the individual, not just their net worth. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So that when we build wealth in families, you know, women and men, that we need to look at the more than just the net worth of a person, because if their relationship is not good, then the woman is going to be out in the cold anyway, because not only is she in a situation where she may be compromised emotionally, then also financially as well, in addition to whatever she brought to the relationship to begin with. And I'll take my
very good point
response off the air. Thank you so much, gentlemen.
Thank you, Carla.
But
and
you
ladies.
Know,
okay.
And the interesting thing, and I'll let our guest comment about this also, Mark, is that I advise my colleagues, women who are my age, 40, and we're talking about relationships and wealth, I remind them that they take on debt when they get married. They not only take on wealth and double their income many times, but they take on that debt as well, because they become liable for that debt. And so, you know, it's something that's cultural. It's something that I think that white community is taken for granted, that you're marrying someone of your similar status, similar education, similar dreams and goals, as Carla was saying. It's not always been that case for how we advise women of color, our daughters of color, our sisters of color, how to. And maybe they don't need our advice anymore, but I look out for the women who are in part of my life.
That's a job.
Yeah, that's right. LaToya, what do you think about that?
I think that it's a major, major consideration. Like, I hate how much a woman's financial future is kind of tied to her choice of mate, but it is what it is.
It is what it is.
And it is what it is. And there, if you are end up with the wrong guys, I've seen many women that I know that I grew up with, and you have, you know, children by him or whatever, you could be in a downward wealth spiral for the rest of your life, particularly battles with, like, addiction and things like that. So I do agree that there should be a lot of outreach toward women of color. One, we do need more information on how to manage our own money, how to make our own money, how to do responsible investments. Because, you know, as we've been running, Racialicious has been running a series based on the Insight Center's research. We've been doing, you know, bit by bit, like, how do you learn about your financial advice? And the women who are commenting who say that they have a good, stable financial history, it's because their parents instilled that they need to be the stewards of their own financial. So that's the big one that a lot of people don't even get that message to begin with. But when we're talking about men specifically and what types of men to look for and to choose, I think some friends and I were talking about the report, and we were talking about how it was a lot easier to get naked with a man than it was to talk about your financial history.
Wow.
Because that seems like it's more personal than your body. Isn't that strange?
That is very strange. Why, you know, it
doesn't come out until much later. And so part of it is kind of like also instilling the fact that it's okay to kind of pull back the curtains a little bit on a financial situation. Like, if you're too embarrassed to talk about your money, clear, there's something else that you have to fix. It's not something that you can just maintain forever. But then there's also the idea that couples, particularly couples, when they start getting more serious, before somebody moves in, before you talk about marriage, before any of those things happen, or if you're, you know, a GLBTQ couple, if you're anti-marriage, what have you, before you start cohabitating, anything that might require you investing your time and your love into this person, you should also talk about how you both invest your money, because that will be such a huge, it can literally break your relationship down. A lot of people separate because of money.
Now, before we run out of time here, I want to ask both of you very quickly, and Mariko and LaToya, in the next few minutes we have, we didn't get into this, this is an important part of the discussion, and maybe have to come back to it, which is, where do we go from here? So we know this is true. The governmental and human changes that have to be made to make this work, and policy changes. Mariko, let me start with you.
Sure. I think one of the main points I want to make is that with any changes that we make, we have to bear in mind that the government is already helping people, or some people, build wealth through its policy. So anytime there's a tax deduction, let's say, you know, the home mortgage interest deduction or savings, your college savings deduction, any kind of tax deduction is actually helping somebody to build wealth because they don't have to pay as much as they would normally have to pay. And there's lots of other examples, but the government's already helping people build wealth. But the problem is that women of color and women and other groups, poor whites also, are left out of the process. So I just want to say that because I don't want people to think, oh, well, we shouldn't have these special policies, you know, for people that you know, to build their wealth when the rest of us have you know, pulled ourselves up by our bootstraps. In reality, the people who have wealth are helped, at least, if not to get their wealth, to maintain their wealth, you know, through the structure of government tax policies and benefit policies. So that being said, I think one of the first things we need to do is really focus on and what that means. And of course, we should care about income, but we need to move well beyond that, you know, to actually think about how can we help people build assets? How does our tax structure leave some people out so that they aren't able to benefit from different policies? And how do we provide opportunities? And one of the major ways is actually through entrepreneurship. Women of color are extremely entrepreneurial, and they do very well when they start their own businesses. So that would be a way, let's say, that that the government or other organizations could really make a difference, is by helping, you know, women take their entrepreneurial talent and, you know, making it a reality.
A final one-minute thought from you, LaToya.
One-minute thought. Okay.
Literally.
I think that one of the great things that we can do to start pushing toward, and I love Mariko, emphasize enough how much I love Mariko's policy-based initiatives in the back of the report. And I feel like that's the first really crucial half. And then the second really crucial half will be to actually direct outreach to these communities that are suffering and really talk about how to build entrepreneurship, how to build networks, how to work with money at levels that you, where you are. Essentially, because I feel like a lot of financial advice is above where a lot of people are. You can't be investing if you're working with only $20 a month. Maybe in 2 years, if you're putting away that $20 a month, you can do it. But you can't. It doesn't make sense. It's not tangible. It's not obtainable to you right now. So I feel like there needs to be definitely bigger pushes in middle school, in high school when kids start getting jobs, in college and beyond, to really discuss what you can do with your money at this stage in your life and how these choices can benefit you or work against you for the rest of your life, because a lot of us find it out the hard way.
LaToya, great analysis on racial issues. You have really broke it down for me. I really understood a lot more through your writing on this report.
So I want to encourage everybody to log on to our website, signourshow.org. You can log on and get the report, Lifting As We Climb, Women of Color, Wealth, and America's Future, and a link to racialissues.com and read what LaToya Peterson's been writing. I want to thank Mariko Chang for doing this report and bringing this out and creating a national discussion. We look forward to having you back and continuing this discussion with LaToya and others to talk about where we go from here as a society. Thank you so much, Mariko.
Thank you, and thank you, LaToya.
Thank you, Mariko.
LaToya Peterson, thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to having you back many, many times. Both of you, thank you so much. And folks, thanks for calling in and bringing your own stories to the airwaves to get to help get this thing going here. And we'll be back in a minute. First, I have to remind you that WEAA is looking for area restaurants and caterers to provide an in-kind food donation to feed our volunteers for our upcoming spring membership drive. By providing an in-kind donation, you have the opportunity to make a unique contribution to WEAA, and we'll be happy to acknowledge your restaurant or business on the air during the spring membership drive. For more information, call 443-885-2075. That's 443-885-2075. We will, when we come back, we are going to have right, left, and center talking about the future of our state. Stay with us.